Hello and welcome back to Channel 9 Live here at Microsoft Ignite. I'm joined by two gentlemen from OSG, from Windows Engineering, by Sunil and Dustin. Guys, Hello. You had some amazing stuff that was inside of that keynote. That was a pretty phenomenal, couple of hours, frankly, of content that we got to see there. Mm-hmm. What is it that you two are actually responsible for inside of OSG? If we start with you, Dustin.
So I work in the operating system security part of the operating systems group. So we build all of the core security features that ship in all the different Windows platforms, from Internet of Things, Windows Phone, PC Client, Xbox, HoloLens, server, the whole thing.
Some of yourself?
So I work in the licensing and deployment group within the operating systems division within in Microsoft. So my team does all of licensing for all Windows flavors and deployment technologies, including updates, upgrades of Windows, Windows Phone, and all of the Windows flavors that Dustin mentioned.
Cool. So I have to say, I'm an absolute geek. I really love everything that we do inside of the company. And for the first time in quite a long time, I'm really excited about logging into my PC. I mean, this is pretty incredible stuff. The fact that all I'm going to need to do is just look at a screen, and I'm going to be signed in.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
So, yes, so we call that Windows Hello. And for years and years, people have talked about the challenges with passwords for a lot of years. And there have been a lot of, I'll say, strong or two-factor authentication solutions in the marketplace for a long time. But they always had the same problem, which was they brought you security at a pretty high cost around user friction. And anytime we see that, you know, with consumers, they just say, no, thank you. You know,
yeah.
That's why so many users don't even have a PIN on their phone, even though they have a credit card in there and everything else. But in business, businesses tend to deploy strong authentication only where they absolutely have to, like for remote access and things like that, because employees complain and there's a lot of friction. With Windows Hello, it's really one of those unique times in security where you can take a big step forward in security and make things much more fun and engaging to use at the same time. I mean, it really is a crowd pleaser. You walk up to your device and it recognizes you and you're right there ready to go. And you just don't normally get an experience like that with security.
Yeah, and I reckon if you actually try to explain to your boss, how on earth can I make it so that, you know, we really need to deploy Windows? Well, that's probably going to be one of the hero things that you're going to do, because as soon as you go into the boardroom and you kind of show the C-level guys, hey, all you have to do to sign in is look at it. You don't need to remember their passwords anymore. That's just going to totally blow them away. But what I love about the way that you guys have actually done this is it's real two-factor auth. It's what you know and what you are. And that's a really, a really core thing to who we are as human beings, that we're actually able to take what you are as a piece of information.
No, that's a really good point, Simon. Actually, biometrics has been around for a while. I mean, we've seen it on different devices and I'll say varying levels of quality. But typically, biometrics is used as what we call a password stuffer. So sure, you get the biometric experience, but the underlying technology is still a password. And as they talked about in the keynote, you know, most attacks against enterprises today start out as identity-based attacks. So by combining Passport with Windows Hello, we're able to take something as easy and fun as biometrics and combine it with the kind of technology and security people expect from a smart card underneath. So it's way more secure and way easier to use at the same time.
We're going to come back to just talking about the security side in a second, but I just want to segue over to talking about deployment as well. We've actually promised the end of rip and replace upgrades with Windows 10. How on earth are we going to make it so that we can deploy Windows in a way which is going to enable business without doing rip and replace?
Absolutely. One of the biggest value props of Windows 10 for enterprises is we want to end the need for wipe and replace, wipe and reload of Windows when you're onboarding a brand new device or whether you're upgrading your existing Windows devices to the Windows 10, right? So we did that by creating two features. First one is we enabled, when you're onboarding a brand new device, you purchase a Windows device from, say, one of the OEMs or a retailer. Mm-hmm. You bring in you can actually onboard the device by simply provisioning that device. The provisioning process could take the Windows queue from a Windows Pro, for example, mm-hmm. to Windows Enterprise automatically, and then it will enroll into your MDM and bring in all of the policies down and get that device ready for the enterprise. So that's onboarding a new device into the enterprise. And in addition, we made significant investment into the upgrade process. We want to help enterprises upgrade their existing devices without having to take them offline, save the data, save the settings, and wipe the device clean and put the new operating system in and bring all of the data back in. In place of that, what we want them to do is simply use their existing management infrastructure like Configuration Manager and run some lightweight scripts to take it from either Windows 7 or Windows 8.1 and do an in-place upgrade to Windows 10. And while keeping the data intact, while keeping the apps intact, while keeping the state of the device intact, and they can do so in like a matter of a couple of hours.
You've given me about five different things there that I actually need to drill into, because at my absolute heart, I'm a deployment geek. And I know that we've got a ton of folks out there who are also real deployment geeks. Send some questions in. Use the app hashtag MSIgnite hashtag. Send them into @channel9. Or in fact, if you're on the live stream on Channel 9, use the Q&A. Get me some questions, and we'll start to ask these guys some of your questions. But I've got one question first, which is, I think, probably on a lot of these guys' minds, which is, if we're going to do in-place upgrade, is it going to be reliable?
Absolutely. For example, at Build, Terry announced that we're expecting 1 billion Windows devices within 2 to 3 year period, right? And we're, at the same time, one of the ways we get to 1 billion devices is by upgrading existing consumer devices to Windows 10, right? And we announced a free upgrade for all of the existing Windows 7 and Windows 8.1 users to Windows 10. So it's not a matter of simply announcing a free upgrade. In addition, we made a significant investment in the upgrade process itself, mainly in the compatibility area, right? So we made sure that all of these consumers will have a great experience with the existing apps that they're using in Windows 7 and 8.1 post their upgrade to Windows 10. So that investment converts directly into the enterprise too. On top of that, we didn't forget the enterprise segment in that process. We actually worked with the top ISVs. For example, what are the enterprise-specific applications that most of the IT cares about? Disk encryption software, anti-malware software, that are specific to enterprises. We're working with the top ISVs to make sure that that software works well with the upgrade process, works well post the upgrade process too, right? So there's been a significant investment to make sure this process is smooth and the experience is great on Windows 10 after the upgrade is done.
And I mean, we all work for the company. We all work for Microsoft. You guys in OSG have actually been dog fooding for a long time. You've been experiencing things in advance, of, obviously, of us pushing stuff to Windows Insiders. That's been a pretty good process as well. So we've actually been moving thousands of devices across many, many builds as we go. And that must be teaching us a lot about the upgrade process.
Absolutely. Some of the learnings that we had was you self-hosting this whole in-place upgrade process through Microsoft IT. Microsoft has close to 100,000 employees, right? And Microsoft IT is moving them from when Windows 8.1 was released, we moved all of the Windows 8 users and Windows 7 users to Windows 8.1 using in-place upgrade.
Yep.
So that gave us a lot of learnings. We took that and we actually made changes into Windows and our upgrade process to make that better moving forward.
I mean, that actually brings me to something which I think is really interesting, actually. And that is, we are just learning so much from telemetry that we're bringing back from all of that dog fooding experience from all of the insiders preview.
Insiders,
that's giving us such good learning. And that's why it's so important that so many people are actually joining in and being a Windows insider. So what kind of information is that kind of helping us with? Is there anything that you can share which isn't kind of giving away the secrets?
Absolutely. For example, we are upgrading, we have around close to 2 million Windows insiders. Every time we release a flight, all of those insiders, the couple of million insiders, they're moving from a particular flight to the next flight through the upgrade in-place upgrade process.
Yeah.
So we're getting the telemetry back from all those 2 million insiders on how the upgrade process is performing, how long did it take, what are the kinks in the process, right? What's the compatibility issue that they're facing, what is the upgrade experience like, and what is the post-upgrade experience like. We're gathering all of the data, and we are making it easier and better on every day.
It is fascinating to be able to kind of see that, because I get to see some of that telemetry myself and just kind of see the speed of uptake of devices being installed. It's pretty phenomenal that we can see that kind of
Absolutely.
Stuff.
Absolutely.
In terms of kind of going back to identity for a little while, can you explain just a little bit around how that's really going to work for enterprises? Because they need a little bit more than it just to authenticate them into Windows. They need to have access to their file servers. And we have something called Passport that I think ties into Windows Hello in a way.
No, absolutely. That's a great question. So, you know, today a lot of enterprises will be starting from Windows 7. So, you know, if I'm using existing devices, maybe those devices don't have biometric support. Microsoft Passport also supports using a PIN. So it acts like just like a smart card that way. And the Microsoft Passport will actually be supported by Microsoft Account, Azure Active Directory, and on-premise Active Directory at launch. So I can use Microsoft Passport with the different identity services that I use today. And as we heard about in the keynote, with all the different software as a service that Azure Active Directory integrates with, I don't have to make any changes. Just by virtue of upgrading to Windows 10 and taking advantage of Microsoft Passport, I can actually replace passwords and have a very, very safe but easy experience for users, because let's face it, PINs are easier than, even PINs are easier than passwords. They have very secure experience, but it works across all that existing infrastructure.
Just to dive into that for a second, one thing that I think folks actually often forget is that PINs can be more secure than a password. And I think that's kind of a strange mindset thing to get your head through, because I guess it's because PINs are less guessable than a a word which is going to be a password. But can you kind of elaborate on that for a second?
Absolutely. Do I have 30 minutes?
You do? No.
We've
got 33,
every
actually.
Every time that we try to have this discussion, that question always comes up.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you've been telling me for years that I need to have this really
complex password.
A password that's 250 characters of Klingon, and I need to change it every 72 days. And now you're telling me that I can be safe with a four-digit PIN. Why is that? Two very important differences. First of all, a password is what we call a network secret. So as an attacker, if I can get your password, I can use that from anywhere. I don't have to have your device. If I can snoop your password, crack your password, knock over a server somewhere and steal your password, any way that I get a hold of your password, I can now be you from anywhere I want to be you. But with a PIN isn't what's used on the network. The PIN is what we call a local secret. So the PIN simply unlocks the device. It unlocks that passport key that's bound to hardware inside the device. So even if I did, there's lots of cameras around here. Let's see if I, enter my PIN right on my device in front of the camera. That does no good to an attacker, because they can't use that to be me unless they also steal my device. So, and the second piece of that that's super important. So the first is, I have to have the device. A PIN is no good to me unless I also steal the device, which is a lot different than a password. Mm-hmm. But the second part is, PINs are protected by what we call hardware-enforced anti-hammering. So we can prevent an attacker from guessing. So as long as you don't do the Spaceballs thing and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, your attacker has 5 guesses before they get locked out in hardware from doing that. So it prevents guessing attacks. Even in the password world, I have unlimited shots at trying to go after your password. They can't use things like anti-hammering. But with things like PINs and local device secrets, I can use the hardware on that device to protect it from guessing by an attacker.
So literally, with something like Windows Hello, your face becomes the PIN. It actually is exactly that same situation.
That's exactly right. And that's another super important point. So whenever, when I go visit different businesses and we talk about this, there's always the security guy in the room. The very first question is like, wait a second, I can change my password. I can't change my face. I can't change my finger. But that's based on a little bit of confusion about how the technology works. If I was using my fingerprints to access a remote service, that would be bad, because if an attacker got the image of my fingerprint, then they could act as me from somewhere else and I could never change my finger. But because, like the PIN, we only ever use it on the device, even if the attacker is, sitting down and, grabbing my coffee cup when I leave Starbucks or whatever they're doing, the fact that they have my fingerprint, the fact that they have a picture of my face, doesn't do them any good unless they also steal my device. And then even when they steal the device, they still have to deal with the anti-spoofing and liveness detection capabilities of Windows Hello.
So Windows Hello will actually be able to tell that it's not just a photograph that I'm holding up in front of my screen. It has some way of telling that I'm alive that I'm real.
Absolutely. That's something we call liveness detection. And Windows Hello, when Windows Hello does face or iris-based detection, it does that using near IR light, not visible RGB light. So if I were to, like if I had a Windows Hello PC right here and I were to show it my smartphone, all it would see is black because that's all, you know, that it's not going to detect any of those colors. Those are RGB colors. And if I walked up with a photograph, all it's going to see is a white sheet of paper.
So how does Windows Hello actually deal with the kind of the mechanics of getting somebody into the right frame? Do they need to be a specific distance away from the camera? Do they have to be at the right height? How does the person know that they're in the right position, I guess?
So Windows Hello, that's part of what makes it fun and engaging. Windows Hello, I think Joe in the keynote said it's security that actually smiles and winks at you. So there's some very simple animations that help the user know that they're in the right place. Now, with face recognition, you saw in the keynote, the minute Joe removed that cloth, it just instantly recognized him. So he didn't have to position himself a certain way. It's a fairly wide field of view. It's really, you know, it's not going to work from 15 feet away, but, you know, like my PC at work, as I'm walking up to my desk, it's already recognized me and it's ready to go. So it's pretty easy to use.
Cool. So the credentials are essentially stored inside of, that's a great question. Where are the credentials stored on your machine?
So in Windows Security, we've been pushing Trusted Platform Modules, or TPMs, for a long, long time. And in fact, in Windows 8 and 8.1, we introduced this technology called Virtual Smart Card. So we wanted to be able to take enterprises who wanted to deploy smart cards, but were kind of struggling with the cost and complexity of deploying all the cards, deploying all the readers, making sure people had readers for all their different devices. So we said, hey, most enterprise devices have a Trusted Platform Module inside. Let's just use that. We've carried that forward in Windows 10, so we'll actually bind your private authentication keys to hardware inside the Trusted Platform Module.
And those keys, I presume, are going to come from Azure Active Directory or from Active Directory as well, I would guess. And then we'll have some kind of mechanism for being able to use them to authenticate to corporate resources. But what about the non-corporate resources? If we've got a technology which is going to be really good inside of the enterprise, is there a really good place to be using it for consumers as well?
Absolutely. So that's why a Microsoft account is going to be supporting Passport from the beginning. So again, from the keynote, most attacks start with my identity being stolen. And if we look at how identities get stolen today, it really happens in one of two ways. Either I get phished, or somebody goes and knocks over a server somewhere. So we saw that it was 6 months ago that a Russian hacking website put up for sale a file with 1.2 billion usernames and passwords.
Wow.
Now today, there's only about 2 billion users online. So that's pretty rough.
Yeah.
And so because those two are the most important threats, by moving even consumer users to Passport and using what we call these asymmetric keys, that means that I can't be phished because, you know, I could actually, if I'm using Passport with my bank and an attacker lures me over to badbank.com and I actually click login, I'm signing an authentication request with my private key and I'm not giving the attacker anything that they could use to then go log in to my real bank. And if they were to go knock over a server somewhere, all they're going to get is this big list of public keys, which are completely useless to the attacker. So just for that reason alone, we want to really aggressively move consumers to this technology. And in the consumer world, when people deploy Passport, they can deploy it in one of two ways. They can either say, I need the most security I can get. I have to be able to use hardware to bind that key and use a process called attestation to prove that that's bound to hardware. But in the consumer world, if I just take someone who doesn't have a TPM, because most consumer devices today don't have a TPM, if I just say, hey, I'm going to let you use, I'm going to use a key that's only bound to software, I'm still protected against phishing. I'm still protected against those servers getting knocked over. The only way that key can be stolen is if an attacker gets to run code malware at admin on my device, which, well, if I was running using a password, I'd already be in a whole lot of trouble anyway.
Yeah, so it'd be a pretty difficult situation, I guess.
Yep.
We've had a question from Vivek around Windows Hello, and does it need any specialist hardware in order to get it up and running? TPM, possibly.
Well, Windows Hello, Passport requires a TPM for enterprises and other identity providers that set a policy that says you must use hardware-based authentication. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, in the Microsoft account example, if I'm just trying to use a site that's very, very low risk, I may want to get all the benefits of asymmetric keys without requiring that the user have specialized hardware. In other words, I want them to be able to use that existing device. But in enterprises, I may want to say, look, only trust devices that can bring hardware level security to the problem. But for Windows Hello, for the biometric side, Windows Hello will work with existing fingerprint readers that are designed to work with the Windows biometric framework. For face recognition and iris recognition, that requires special hardware. It uses that low IR spectrum technology that I spoke about earlier. But there are devices available today, such as Intel RealSense cameras, that support Windows Hello for face recognition. So,
cool. So we should start to see OEMs actually building some of this into their hardware in the future.
The very near future. Very near future. I think you'll see a lot of different solutions before the end of this calendar year.
I think that's going to make it really exciting, again, to go and look at being able to do a hardware refresh inside of an organization. It's going to be one of those things that you really want to be thinking, what do I need for this next generation? If you're about to go and purchase a load of equipment, it's time to actually put a think on that and say, hey, have I actually validated that this is going to have what I need in there? So I think that's a pretty good place to be. Let's park security for a little bit. I want to come back and actually delve into some of the other security features that we're building into the platform. But let's go back to deployment for a moment. And the end of rip and replace upgrades, you mentioned that we can see a situation where a user walks into their favorite electronics retailer,
mm-hmm.
buys a device,
yep.
and wants to use it for business.
Yep.
How do they go about, how do we kind of get as an IT organization get the control over that device that we need to have trust that the information that's stored on it is going to be safe?
Absolutely. So the first thing that the user needs to do after purchasing that device is the user needs to enroll the device with the enterprise. Mm-hmm. That enrollment process is the one that brings down the corporate policies, the enterprise policies that dictate whether the Windows Hello could be used with Microsoft Passport, that's actually bound to a hardware or not, right? So all of that policies are basically coming down as part of the provisioning process. So with Windows 10, we built a new deployment tool called Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer. This is a tool that helps the enterprise admins to create these provisioning packages that can be sent using MDM, or they can even send them in an email, and then the user can open the attachment, and then the provisioning process gets kicked off. So you can use an MDM process, email, just run it from a USB key, the provisioning package. Any of that, any of the different methods of the provisioning the device would actually help the device get enrolled into the enterprise. Once that process is complete, now enterprise has the sufficient control in managing the device and ensuring the compliance of the device meets the needs of the enterprise.
And kind of what kind of things could I do with the provisioning package? I presume that I could, one of the things that I'd probably like to be able to do, you go into one of those stores, you pick up a corporate device, it's probably got some software on there that I don't particularly love as an enterprise. Is there a way for me to get that off?
If assuming that the software is known, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the ways you could do it is, I think somebody was asking the question, is that, hey, is that when we say end of wipe and reload, are we going to not support it anymore? No, if the enterprise wants to say that we want to start with a clean slate and that's our process, absolutely, we continue to support that too, right? And in addition, if somebody wants to say customer chooses their own device, they bring it in, and I want to be able to manage to that meets, as long as it meets my compliance needs, I'm comfortable with that, and we support that too. For example, in the provisioning process, the enterprise can dictate saying, here are the start menu layout. Here are the few apps that come down automatically for you. I know that you're a sales team member, so I'm going to provision all of the sales apps by default onto your start menu, right? And I'm going to control the desktop background, if that's of interest for the enterprise, right? So anything that you can typically do with a group policy and domain join enrollment processes in the past, you could do it with provisioning packages.
And could I kind of layer on top of each other these different pieces of management? So say I have some users who they're not the most savvy people. I think that's fair to say. We often come across users who are not particularly tech savvy.
Yeah.
I could send them an email with a provisioning package in there. Could that then go off and make it do a, an MDM enrollment?
Yep.
And then I could centrally manage all of my policies.
That is absolutely correct. That's exactly the point. Once the user gets the device, and they can get a mail from the enterprise. And once the user double clicks on that and a provisioning package, it kicks off the MDM enrollment process. Once it's complete, it's all the same as a corporate device at that time, right? So enterprise has complete control of that device if they choose to.
And if I was to, I presume I could do the same kind of thing to do a domain enrollment or something, maybe join Azure Active Directory. If I was also pushing down some group policy, all those kind of things, Windows does actually just work out what to do. We've got so many different management points in there that if I'm pushing something down through MDM and I'm pushing something down through group policy, I could be sending out, I could be creating a VB script and sending out some wild WMI queries. Windows is intelligent enough to just work with that.
That's right. So with Windows 10, one of the things that's happening in the client is we're combining all of this MDM client and configuration management client, all of the WMI policies that these guys that used to exist in Windows 8 and before, we're all combining that into one central engine within Windows. So that it's up to the enterprise admin to pick and choose what mechanism they want to leverage. Whether it could be MDM that's Intune from Microsoft, or a third-party MDM like MobileIron or AidWatch, or use a domain join, and I'm going to use Active Directory to push group policy, or I'm going to use Configuration Manager to send down some of the policies. And all of those options are available within Windows 10.
It sounds like we're actually creating an incredibly flexible deployment environment for people, where, unlike other operating systems, you can literally choose the right kind of way to deploy this operating system, the one that fits for you. Because you mentioned it really quickly there, but it's not like we're going to deprecate the ability to do an image-based installation. That's not going to go away, is it?
That's right. Yeah. It's not going to go away. That's correct.
So everybody's investment, the learning that they've all done inside of how to deploy using WIM files, how to deploy using MDT.
That's right.
All of that is going to be kind of combined, and it's going to be a really good thing for them. If you were actually advising people the one thing that they really ought to learn about doing deployment for Windows 10, what would you suggest that they should be looking at specifically?
Right now, I would say sign up for the Windows Insider Program. Yep. Start testing Windows 10 in your environment. We leverage the in-place upgrade process and ensure that the corporate line of business applications are compatible. If not, give providers feedback and try out the tools like Windows Imaging and Configuration Designer.
Yeah.
And that would be the great starting step.
Yeah, I think if one of the things that I've seen a few times is people saying, hey, Microsoft, you're not giving me enough notice about the fact that you're changing the operating system.
That's right.
There's not exactly an excuse for that. We've been giving people insider builds for quite a few months now.
Yeah.
It should be possible to have actually taken an application and tested it by the time that we get to more significant moments. There's a couple of questions coming around, kind of specifically around deployments. Firstly, this one from David. How will domain administrators be able to control who gets a Windows 10 update in small domains without Configuration Manager?
So
I guess we'd be kind of looking for Windows. I guess we'd be kind of looking at how can we control updates through group policy, through MDM.
So if your enterprise has a configuration manager, obviously it's great. Most likely you're leveraging a WSUS environment to control the update process itself, right? With Windows 10 update, the free upgrade for consumers that every consumer machine is going to get, for Windows domain join machines, the enterprise admins have an option of pushing that update to all of the domain join machines. They don't automatically get this update by consumers did, right? So the domain administrators continue to have the control that they had with all of the Windows update packages from the past, and it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
same way.
That kind of brings us to some of the stuff that Terry mentioned in the keynote there about Windows Update for Business. Probably people are just kind of trying to understand that information a little bit at the moment. Can you just kind of recap what Terry said there?
Absolutely. So Terry announced Windows Update for Business this morning. Windows Update for Business is our attempt to streamline the update process for enterprises who have lots of devices that are used by their enterprise end users, where innovation in functionality and new features is required. And it's not like it's not the case with, they're different from the mission critical systems where reliability is of paramount importance, but they want the information workers within the enterprise to get that latest features as soon as possible.
Yeah.
So today the way the enterprises control that is through WSS and Configuration Manager. And that's expensive from a management perspective, the server cost and everything. So with Windows Update for Business, you can offload all of that process and leverage Windows Update for Business from the cloud, and you can actually put all of the information workers' devices in, to connect them to Windows Update for Business, and you have the same flexibility in terms of controlling when the updates will happen, and how soon and how frequently, and what kind of reporting you may need to generate out of the base, because you have some compliance requirements on whether the machine is up to date or not. All of that functionality will exist, but you're removing all of the cost of managing your own WSS server and sending those updates by and pushing them out yourself as an enterprise.
So it should be one of those things that folks should really grasp and try and understand some of the nitty-gritty of that, because that's going to be one of those areas which is going to really move things forward.
That's right. It will help the information workers get to the feature set really fast, and in a flexible manner, and at the same time, reduce costs for the enterprise.
There's another question that we just had come in from Kenny Chan, and this lends itself perfectly, actually, to the idea of edition upgrades. So the question is, it's always been a little bit painful to do an edition upgrade. So imagine that situation. You go and acquire a device. Normally, it comes with an OEM license on it. You actually have a volume license. You want to be replacing the license key on there. You want to move from Pro to Enterprise. On Windows 7, Windows 8, that's a rip and replace upgrade
that
right there.
Good.
That's a costly thing to do. So we've addressed that inside of Windows 10. But just talk to me a little bit about how.
So we enabled this process, edition upgrade process called Transmog, for those who are actually familiar with edition upgrades within Windows. So we enabled upgrading, doing an in-place edition upgrade on Windows devices starting from Pro to Enterprise. So if you acquire a device, and that's Windows Pro, you don't have to do the clean reinstall. You can bring down a provisioning package part of the enrollment or as part of the domain join process. When the enrollment, the provisioning package comes down, that can bring down the licensing information, whether it's the volume licensing information that these guys have or any other enterprise licensing mechanisms that we have. The information comes down, and the machine, in like a matter of a few minutes, goes from Pro to Enterprise, and then it's life goes on normal from there.
I've actually experienced that a couple of times myself. I've been working on some demos for Ignite, mm-hmm. which do exactly that, and I've done that mechanism I've done that upgrade through a variety of different mechanisms, and it's always pretty cool. It just moves me up. It's very lightweight for the user. I don't have to go back and reinstall everything, reinstall my apps, get my settings back running. It's really nice.
That's right. And that process is controlled through any of the MDM flavors that we discussed, Intune, AirWatch, MobileIron, and because the functionality is available as an MDM client piece, right? And then through Configuration Manager. So regardless of what kind of management infrastructure the enterprise has, they have this ability within Windows Client.
OK, cool. I think there's a lot of really cool deployment stuff coming
Absolutely.
Inside of Windows 10. It's pretty amazing. I want to switch back to device security for a little bit. We mentioned malware and phishing attacks and users doing things that we don't normally expect them to do, like just running an executable, even elevating privileges on that executable. We saw that inside of the keynote as well. There's a technology inside of Windows 10 called Device Guard that's going to help protect the device integrity, I guess. Can you talk a little bit about that? And while you're doing that, one of the questions that we had was, how does it differ from other technology like AppLocker?
Device Guard is another one of those things that could spend an awful lot of time talking about, because it's Device Guard is actually a suite of capabilities on the device that kind of culminates in what you saw in Brad's keynote. So in Brad's keynote, you know, a user got sent a piece of malware, tried to click on it, and the system said, no, sorry, you can't do that. That's not compliant with the policy inside my organization. Now, there have been solutions around for a while that basically say it's OK to run this, it's not OK to run this. But all of those different solutions are susceptible to malware attacks that can get to kernel-level code execution, right? So, and we've seen this a lot, right? Every time malware gets into the kernel, when somebody wants to be persistent on a device, I need to get into the kernel, or even worse, into the BIOS, so I can sit underneath the protections of the system and turn them off, right? If I can get underneath your anti-malware software and hide in a way that you can't see me, then I can always act with impunity. You can't see me, you can't remove me, et cetera. So Device Guard represents a suite of technologies that work from the moment the initial boot block loader for the firmware gets loaded and validated, all the way up to the point where a user tries to click on an application. But there really are some game-changing technologies in there, probably the most remarkable of which is our bet on hypervisor-based security. Mm-hmm. Windows 8 and Windows 8.1, you know, we really took the world forward from Windows 7 by saying, look, we're going to bet on hardware-based security. We're seeing all these rootkit attacks. We're seeing BIOS-based attacks. So, you know, we're gonna move the ecosystem to secure boot. In Windows 10, we take a huge gear on that strategy by moving to a hypervisor-based security model, where the on Device Guard ready devices, you can turn this suite of capabilities on, and then the hypervisor's always on, and we take some of the most sensitive and important security features of Windows, and we move those off into a separate teeny tiny edition of the OS. It's basically something we call virtual secure mode. And that way, for the things that we moved over there, they're protected, even in the face of complete kernel mode compromise of the main OS. So, and two of the most interesting things that we move over there are the local security authority, or LSA. That's the thing that has all your secrets and hashes and things like that. Those are that have heard about pass the hash. That's an attack against the local security authority. The other thing we move over there, and this is super interesting, is the Windows kernel code integrity module. So the kernel code integrity actually runs from a separate secure execution environment. The main OS doesn't get to load its own kernel mode code. So the secure execution environment can do all kinds of interesting things, such as ensure we're always doing SHA-256 validation of any kernel mode code that loads, and ensuring that we never have kernel mode memory pages that are marked writable and executable at the same time, which is how all these attackers carry out arbitrary code attacks in the kernel. So on the surface, in the demo, it looked like I just clicked on something and didn't run. So what? I can do that with other stuff. But with all of the Device Guard technologies underneath, we're making it incredibly difficult, much, much more challenging than it's been in the past, for an attacker to get a successful compromise running in the kernel and staying persistent on the device.
And I think I'm right in my understanding that enterprises actually have control over what can be executed as well. So they can actually say, these specific applications are OK. Other applications, not so much. And I guess that's where folks get the confusion with what AppLocker can do.
Sure. So AppLocker, you know, allowed you to say, hey, it's OK to run stuff that's in this file path or has these hashes or assigned by these folks. With Device Guard, we're able to say, hey, enterprise, you can have complete cryptographically assured control over what runs based on signing policy and say, look, only run stuff I sign. Now, that's great, except there's some enterprises that are like, hey, we don't sign our stuff, or we don't have PKI in our environment. And so we're going to make it easy for them. We're all about easy. We're going to be standing up a service that allows an enterprise to, we'll actually generate a private code signing key for that enterprise. Mm-hmm. We'll generate their own code integrity policy that they can distribute to these Device Guard ready devices. And we'll sign their stuff. We'll either, they can send us their actual line of business applications to sign, or they can create, if they don't want to send us their line of business applications, they can just create a hash catalog, and we'll give them tools to do that, send that to us, and we'll sign the hash catalog, the catalog signing.
Oh, wow.
And just make it super easy for them. They don't have to be experts in signing. They don't have to stand up their own PKI. Now, We know there are enterprises that are like, hey, love what you're doing there, but I want to manage my own key. I want to sign my own stuff. All the tools will be available for them to do that.
Awesome. I think we've just got such a phenomenal set of capabilities that your teams are bringing into this next version of Windows. And it's so much stuff to be really excited about in terms of Windows 10. Guys, I just want to thank you both very much for joining us on the Channel 9 live stage as the first guests at Ignite that are going to be on the stage. So pretty cool stuff, the inaugural two guests of the entire conference on the stage. Hopefully you guys found that incredibly interesting. We're going to be doing a load more interviews over the course of the week of Ignite with other folks from various parts of the engineering organizations around Microsoft, hopefully bringing you directly the information that you really need in order to be able to go ahead and embrace some of the amazing things that we're showing you here at Microsoft Ignite. So without further ado, we're going to cut out to a break for a second or so, and we'll be back a little later on.